I would like to convene this meeting of the Lincoln County Board of Commissioners. Good morning and welcome. It is Wednesday, September 7th, 2016. All three commissioners are present, and that constitutes a quorum. We start off with employee length of service recognitions. We've got a very long list this morning, and I'm going to step out here. And for the employees who are present, I would like to ask you to come forward to receive your certificate and your service pin, and also ask you to please stay up here. Mr. Miller is going to take a group photograph when we're done. Okay, first up, Cheryl Connell, Health and Human Services. 5 years of service. I do not see Cheryl here today. And we should note that an asterisk goes with that because it's 5 years this time. Cheryl actually has two previous terms of service with the county, but this is her fifth time around. Her fifth year this time around. Okay, Jenny Maris. Is Jenny here?
Yes.
Boy, it sure seems like Jenny just got started with us yesterday, but 5 years already. Okay. Julia Keller, Juvenile Department, 5 years of service. Okay. Eric Larson, Sheriff's Office, 5 years. Thank you. Congratulations. Jennifer Landers, Community Justice, 10 years. Justin Reed, Assessor's Office, 10 years. Okay. Ethan Nicely, Surveyor, 15 years. Diana Fletcher, DA's Office, 20 years. Scott Branchfield, Assessor, 25 years.
Wow.
Time flies when you're having fun, everybody, right? Mark Meister, Sheriff's Office, another 25-year employee. And Tyree Reswick, also 25 years with the Sheriff's Office. Congratulations. Okay, Casey.
Bill, can you move to your left a little?
Okay.
Keep going, keep edging, bump her over a little.
Okay.
Okay, that's good. All right. Okay.
Close the door on
him. I thought we liked Casey, but we wanted to make life easier for him, not more difficult. Okay, thank you all. We'll make sure that the folks who weren't able to make it receive their pins and certificates. All righty, Dale. Time for introduction. You know, the folks who we hope we're going to be seeing regularly for these kind of ceremonies in a few years, but we have the county new hire tour visiting with us today. All righty, if you'd like to have the folks introduce themselves, tell us who you are and where you're working.
I'm Breeze Powell. I'm a new nurse here in Newport. I just graduated in June, and
got hired on with the wonderful maternal case management group over there, and I'll be working in the Western Title Building when I'm not out and about in the community.
Great.
Yeah.
My name is Alyssa Ely, and I just got hired on as a community health nurse and Veterans Administration nurse, and I also just graduated from our community college. So.
I'm Stacy Sines. I've been a nurse a long time, and I came from Boise, and I'll be working at the Nye Clinic Community Health.
I'm Colleen Chavarria with Environmental Health. I grew up here. I'm so happy to be back in my home county, so looking forward to everything that life brings.
Well, welcome or welcome home to all of you, and thank you, and look forward to seeing you back here in 5 years for a pin and a certificate, but of course, before that as well, you're welcome anytime as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Righty. I did not see Nancy Mitchell. Is she here? Oh, she is. Sorry, big crowd. Come on up, Nancy, please. We have a proclamation of September 2016 as Hunger Action Month in Lincoln County, and I will read that proclamation and then turn things over to Nancy. Whereas Food Share of Lincoln County was incorporated in 1982 to alleviate hunger in Lincoln County by collecting, storing, and distributing food to its network of partner agencies. Whereas each month Food Share of Lincoln County provides emergency food in excess of 80,000 pounds, serving approximately 4,500 individuals, including working families with children, senior citizens, veterans, the disabled, and homeless. Whereas it is important that all Lincoln County residents participate by contributing food, money, or volunteering time at a local food pantry, shelter, or soup kitchen, and by encouraging others to get involved. And whereas the ultimate goal of Food Share of Lincoln County is to break the cycle of poverty by educating community members and elected officials about the causes of hunger and poverty, and advocates for policies that improve the lives of low-income people. And whereas Food Share of Lincoln County is committed to creating a future without hunger, where access to healthy food by all is recognized as fundamental to the well-being and success of individuals and the foundation of a strong, vibrant community. Now, therefore, the Lincoln County Board of Commissioners does hereby proclaim the month of September 2016 as Hunger Action Month in Lincoln County. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning.
And we know you, but for the audience, please introduce yourself.
My name is Nancy Mitchell, and I'm the Executive Director of Food Share of Lincoln County. In my 20th year of employment
at
Food Share, so
it's been
a good ride.
Years.
Yeah, where's my pin? I'll have to talk to my board of directors about that. Anyway, thank you so much for proclaiming September as Hunger Action Month in Lincoln County. As you know, this is a very important issue, and it's really not acceptable that people can't meet their basic needs in these times. And although we always emphasize when we're out in the community talking about Food Share and what we do, we always emphasize that we are addressing hunger all year round. So not just during the holidays, you know, but really year round. But this particular time of year presents quite a few challenges for families and individuals in our community. For instance, summer is a challenging time for families with children. We have a lot of children in the schools that access free breakfast and lunch program. During the summer, they may not be accessing those meals. I know there's some summer lunch programs available, but for the most part, they're eating more meals at home, and this adds an additional stress on families and their budgets. So also it's a challenge for our programs to keep up with the additional usage of food assistance programs. So that's a kind of a double challenge there. And also on top of that, summer is a time where donations, both food and monetarily, just decrease significantly. It's just not on a lot of people's radar this time of year. So it's fall, it's back to school, kids are back in school. They're going to be able to access these extra meals, which will take a little bit less pressure off the families with school-age children. But there's still, Labor Day is coming on, there's still challenges for people, especially within our hospitality and service industry in our community. You probably are aware that, you know, after the tourism cycle ends, that hours get cut, and, you know, that makes it difficult for people to make ends meet, you know, in the next couple of months. And also, the holidays are right around the corner, so that's another added, you know, stressor on finances for families. So that's about families and children and how this Hunger Action Month can really help support some of these needed, you know, additional needs that our families are facing right now. Shifting the focus from families with children, I'd like to share a couple sentiments about yet another vulnerable population that also struggles to make meet their basic needs, and that's senior citizens. And I'd like to share a couple sentiments from a couple seniors that have shared their stories with us. So this is from a senior citizen who sat in on a focus group to share the circumstances that led her to the door of a food pantry. My name is Maggie. My hope for the future is that my children and my grandchildren's lives are easier. I live on my own and don't have anyone to help me. It's a lot of worry at times. Employment is difficult in this county. I put out dozens of applications and resumes and only received one call back. So I count on our food bank and the $20 I receive in food stamps. The first time I went into the food bank, I was desperate. The dignity part is hard. But when I went through, I learned that some of the volunteers have also used the program and that they give back by volunteering to help others. That's one reason I think they are so kind, because they understand. It's hard to go from working your entire life and because of a disease, you lose your job and go on disability. I've had to have surgery, and what an eye-opener that was. You go from surviving quite well to barely making it. I've been working through this for the last couple years, and 2 years into it, I'm still learning and finding out more information. I had no clue. So that's, you know, some issues that some of our seniors are facing. This is a thank you note that we received from a couple who use one of the food share programs. Since we retired, we have experienced much more difficulty keeping to our budget, especially with food. So much more of our income has had to go to medical coverage and co-pays that our grocery budget has suffered. Then a friend told us about your ministry at Calvary Baptist Church, and we began coming as regularly as we could. Getting some of the basics and even specialty items that you make available weekly has made a huge difference for us, and we want you to know how much we appreciate it. So I like to share these stories because we can throw a lot of service numbers out there and a lot of statistics and how many pounds we distribute, but these are the people we're helping. And in fact, last year we distributed a record high of over 1 million pounds of food for the entire year. So the need is still great. There's a lot of challenges out there, especially in our coastal community. And I want to just thank the community and everyone involved. We wouldn't have been able to distribute those 1 million pounds of food without the support of our individual donors, our business donors, the faith community, our grantors, our elected officials, and hundreds of volunteers. So we're making this village, and we're helping people as much as we can. So we really, really, really appreciate the community support. And the you know, the highlight of making this Hunger Action Month and really bringing some awareness, and hopefully people will learn ways that they can take action this month to help, you know, our friends and neighbors in Lincoln County. So, but I want to specifically thank you, commissioners, and soon to be a lot of Lincoln County employees for walking the walk, because you're kicking off Hunger Action Month with your two-week-long food drive within your Lincoln County employees. So we're excited to see the results of that. We appreciate it very much that you're willing to do that. I know it takes a little bit of coordination, but we really appreciate it. And we've had great results in the past. You all have raised thousands of pounds of food or thousands of dollars. And so in our food resourcing world, we can distribute up to 5 pounds of food for every dollar. So you can do the math. It's quite significant for what you've all done. Also, in closing, I'd like to just invite you to our donor appreciation event. I think you've all received invitations. That's September 16th from 5:30 to 7, and that's at our Food Share Warehouse location on Northeast 1st Street. We're going to have, it's not going to be glamorous by any means because it's a warehouse, but it's going to be very informative, and we really want to take the opportunity to thank our donors, not ask them for anything more, just strictly thank them, and by donors I mean supporters of all kinds. and we hope that you can make it. So you can take a little tour and see what we do. If you can't make it that night, you're welcome to come by for a tour anytime. We're, you know, we're around most of the time. So again, we appreciate your support and thank you for making this proclamation.
Thank you, Nancy. And yes, big hats off to all Lincoln County employees who really enter into the spirit of this year after year. We set up kind of a nice, friendly spirit of competition, and we weigh contributions averaging out on a per-person basis so our smaller departments and offices can compete on an equal footing with our larger departments and offices. And what goes with it is bragging rights and a nice plaque that the winning office gets to display. You know, we used to offer as the winning benefit that the commissioners would come and work in that department for a day, but then one year the IT department won it, and they said, we're not letting those guys stay here. So that's when we came up with the plaque, and we'll look forward to another good year. A couple of things I wanted to ask you. How many pantries are part of the network in Lincoln County now? I know it's seems like every few months, every year I hear of a new one opening up.
Yeah, well, there's six pantries that we work directly with as far as getting food from our warehouse. You all know about Nashville, the Nashville Food Pantry out that way. They actually work directly with Lynn Benton Food Share, but they still serve Lincoln County residents. So they're still a part of our network. Those are the immediate emergency programs, along with the hot meal sites where people can get a hot meal anytime. But we also support a lot of what we call supplemental programs. And these are senior and youth outreach programs where their main function is not food, but it's, let's say, you know, some sort of youth outreach program. And the kids that they're using in their programs are coming hungry and that kind of thing. So we help those programs with, you know, very inexpensive food items for to feed their residents or their, you know, the program recipients. So, you know, people like My Sister's Place, agencies like that. So we were expanding out in a lot of those different ways in helping the supplemental food programs.
Yeah. A pretty big distribution network. One other thing, and then I'm sure my colleagues will want to have some comments or questions, but you said averaging 4,500 people a month, and depending on the sources you look at, the population of Lincoln County is around 45, 46,000. So that's roughly 10% of the population that's being helped to some extent by Food Share. And just curious, is that number been on the rise, holding steady?
It's on a slow rise.
Okay.
Yeah, it goes up every year. And a lot of the folks that use our programs may only use them two or three times a year, so that's, you know, it's a real rough average. But and we like to be able to think that our programs offer just that. So people that are in between jobs or like some of these senior citizens that are facing challenges, we do sometimes have monthly, you know, recipients that use the programs on a monthly basis, and those are probably usually people on fixed incomes. But on the average, people use these programs just to kind of get by, so two to three times a year possibly.
Okay. Commissioners, comments or questions?
Well, I'd like clarification on what you're just talking about, Nancy. The mix of people that use your services, is it changing to more people just kind of a temporary need and then they're able to move ahead on their own? Or are you seeing the mix change so that more and more people are continuously or long-term dependent on your services? Does that question make sense?
Yeah. And I think it's really both. You know, we do have people that utilize the programs ongoing. But, you know, we've heard stories from people who just said, you know, I lost my job and I had to go to the pantry a couple times, you know, in the last couple months. But now I'm working again and I don't have to use it anymore. So I think it's, you know, really both. Yeah.
Then, again, clarification on what's the relationship and how do you work with the pantries? I'm aware of the Nashville one. I believe what Lincoln City, Newport have pantries also. How's that working? How's that work from an operational standpoint?
So we serve as the distribution center for these programs, And we're still trying to explain a transition that happened a couple years ago where at the Food Share building, we had the warehousing operation going on where we collect food locally, and through our resource at Oregon Food Bank in Portland, that food is warehoused and distributed out to different programs. For many, many years, we had a pantry that did direct service to the Newport residents, and that service has since moved off location. So people sometimes are confused about, you know, Food Share doesn't really do direct services anymore. We're strictly the warehouse operation. So we bring the food in and we distribute it out to our agencies throughout the week. And we do a lot of deliveries too, because our a lot of these pantries are volunteer run. They're in, you know, church basements or whatever, that kind of thing. So our role is to bring the food in, provide as much support as we can in the food distribution part of it. We also provide monetary support. For instance, we share the social service allocation funds that we receive from the county with our agencies. So we offer monetary and, you know, food distribution support.
Good work. So I know that some types of food are more difficult than others for you to acquire. What kind of foods do you find that are in demand that are the most difficult to get contributed to you?
My first answer would be meat. So, and in fact, I'm glad you asked that question, because the food supply has changed quite a bit. And, you know, back in the day, there was mainly shelf-stabled canned food. And, you know, some of that can be pretty high sodium and pretty highly processed food. So we're trying to get away from making that the main source of our food supply. So we're now handling a lot more produce. Last year, out of the 1 million pounds we distributed, over 100,000 pounds of that was fresh produce. So we're really quite proud of that fact, and we know how important it is for the nutritional factor. We also are involved in what's called the Fresh Alliance program, and that's where we go around to our local grocery partners, and we're picking up perishable foods from them, dairy items, produce from their produce departments, meat, that kind of thing. But it's challenging because it's perishable food, and we have to bring it in and get it out as quickly as we can.
I know some of the fishing industry, the sports industry, has got into making trips or having tournaments, and then the food is contributed to you. How do you pull that off? How do you go about, because a lot of it's tuna.
Yes.
How do you go about getting the fish handled and flayed and into the people's hands in a timely manner?
Volunteers.
Volunteer tuna flayers are hard to find.
Yes. Now, that tuna classic derby has not gone on here for a couple of years, because when they tried to do it here in Newport, it usually got canceled due to high winds, and they couldn't go out, you know, on that scheduled day. They're still doing it in the northern coastal parts of Oregon. But we do have ODF&W brings fish to us from the Sletz Trap and sometimes the Salmon River Trap. So oftentimes we get 50 whole fish at a time delivered to the Food Share warehouse, and we have a wonderful crew of volunteers who are skilled at filleting, and they fillet the fish and package it up, and it goes out into the emergency food system. So I hope that stays intact, because that's a wonderful item to be able to offer to people.
Well, I know there was some sportsmen talked about doing it. I don't know if this is possible or if it's even done, but actually making tuna trips where if they have a good catch, which is more than most people want to deal with,
right,
they can call you and you'll get the fish and process it and put it in Food Share, and they can get a tax deduction. Am I correct?
You are correct.
It sounds like a good program to maybe
yeah,
fit be developed.
Yeah, hopefully
we'll
see some tuna pretty soon.
Well, there's been some in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, yeah. So, we deal mostly with salmon, but we could definitely do the tuna too. So thank you for bringing that up.
All right, anything else?
I'd just like to make an observation. I thought it was interesting when Nancy was talking about high sodium foods. Some of our new employees and nurses were nodding.
We're working on it.
We already have some collaborative efforts going on there.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Are we ready for a motion?
I'll move for approval of the resolution proclaiming the month of September 2016 Hunger Action Month in Lincoln County, Oregon.
Second.
Moved and seconded. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. It's approved. Thanks, Nancy.
Thank you. Hope to see you on the 16th.
Yeah. Okay. I'll be in Chicago.
Okay. Well, you'll be with us in spirit.
Will be on my way back from a meeting in Skepoose, but I think I'll be able to make it. So we'll see.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Okay. Next up, the consent calendar. Routine items or items discussed at previous meetings. Anything that staff or commissioners wish to highlight or approve? If not, I'll entertain a motion.
Move for approval of the consent calendar.
Second.
Moved and seconded to approve the consent calendar. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. It's approved. We move on to discussion and information and a presentation, Central Lincoln People's Utility District and solar power.
Hi. Thanks for having us.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome. Please introduce yourselves and take it away.
Great. So my name is Deborah Smith, and I'm the general manager at Central Lincoln PUD. And Wade Carey is our energy services manager, and he's the guy that folks all across town and actually all across our district talk to when they're interested in doing conservation or weatherization or in this case, installing some form of renewable distributed generation on their home. So just really quickly by way of introduction, so Central Lincoln is a people's utility district, which means we're owned by the communities that we serve, and we actually serve folks in 10 municipal cities across parts of 4 counties. So we have our headquarters and our main or largest operations center here in Lincoln County, and so we very much consider ourselves to be Lincoln Countyers, and many of us live and work here. And I would just note, connecting back to the last item, that across this country, the American Public Power Association, on an annual basis, they have October is a public power month, and there is actually a public power week where the benefits of public-owned critical infrastructure are acknowledged. And so one of the things Central Lincoln is doing this year in conjunction with Wade is that we will be offering or doing a food drive for our customers and folks who come into any of our offices. We have customer offices in Reedsport, in Florence, and in Newport. They will be able to make a food donation to the local food bank, and in return they will get an LED light bulb from Central Lincoln. So we'll be happy to make that contribution to the food share, and that's one of the ways that we support the communities that we serve. And that actually was an idea that was generated by our employee advisory committee. So we have a group of employees who say, what are the ways or what are the most important ways that we can be part of the communities we serve? And that was an idea that was generated out of that group. So excited to be part of that. So we aspire as a publicly owned utility, as a community owned utility, to deliver the products and services that our customers are asking for. And we certainly all know that solar and in fact any form of distributed generation is something that is increasingly popular with our customers, not just here but actually across the United States. And I know Mark Salins has had some conversation with you. We've had some with him, and it's been good conversation. And one of our interests is just making sure that people in the coastal communities are receiving information that's applicable to them with respect to the benefits that distributed generation and rooftop solar can provide. So the last thing I would note is just, and then Wade's going to make a presentation, and I think it'll be informative for all of you, and we look forward to continuing to work with Mark on how we can partner to deliver products and services, again, that benefit our mutual constituents. But I would also say that last week a couple of us had an interesting conversation with SolarCity. So Wade will talk very briefly at the end of the presentation about community solar, but that's an opportunity for us that may make more sense just because of the opportunities we have in terms of siting and affordability for customers. And we've actually started a dialogue, and that's Elon Musk, so those are the big boys, and they don't do residential solar in this part of the country, but they do have a relationship with Walmart here locally. And so we're exploring opportunities with them, how they might be a partner for us, and that's not something we've even talked with Mark about. So I think with that, I'll turn it over to Wade and then be available to answer questions you might have afterwards.
Okay. Good morning, and thank you for allowing me to come in and give this presentation. And Deborah, thank you for the introduction. So we'll go ahead and jump right into it. I take calls weekly from customers who are interested in renewable energy in general, but mostly it's solar. And these are the things that we're hearing, or that I'm hearing from them, is they want to save money on their bills, they want to be carbon free, they want to be able to get off the grid, they think the technology is awesome, and that they'll have a backup generation source in the event of a natural disaster or something of that nature. And this is kind of the situation that we in. So what customers are hearing out there is the rainbow, solar, wind, all of that great, but this picture is a little more of a true representation for the Central Oregon coast and what solar is. If you recognize the picture there's some solar panels on what used to be the Nye Beach Inn, or is now the Nye Beach, used to be Greenstone. And those panels were working that day, just albeit not very well. So rooftop solar, and that's what we're going to focus this topic on today. And we're going to go over the ownership trends, generation characteristics, the offset of carbon-producing generation, the system resiliency in the event of a natural disaster, the economics of a system, and also some other options versus renewable that's out there. So ownership trends have dramatically been on the rise. As you can see by the graph there, back in 2001, Central Lincoln got their first net metering customer, solar photovoltaic customer, and we had that one customer all the way until 2007. And then in 2007, it's been on a pretty steady increase. A lot of that's been as a result of the prices. The prices of solar has come down quite a bit over the past decade and a half. We currently have about 55 net metering solar customers. You can see the increase 140% just from 2008 to 2013. And currently those 55 net metering customers represents about 693 kilowatts of power production capability. Okay? So
what does that mean, 693 kilowatts? Would that run my flashlight, my house, my farm?
That's 693,000 watts of power. So that is take for instance, a 5,000 watt generator would run most things in your house with the exception of your water heater and your heater in the event of emergency. So that gives you kind of the idea. Now that's the capability of those systems. Whether or not we're getting that much out of them is debatable. Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So the, like I said, it does generate here on the coast, but how well? Okay, we have a couple things working against us here in Oregon, notably our northern latitude. Because we're so high in the latitude of the Earth, our sun moves greatly in our horizon. Okay, so that leads to, in order to get good quality generation out of a solar panel, you want a good angle of incidence on the panel. 90 degrees from the sun to the surface of the panel will give you the best generation. Well, most rooftop solar applications are stationary mounts, and we get a sun that moves like this. And this, so, depending on the angle of the roof, and the, if you've got a very steep roof, which some roofs here in Oregon are, you get a really good angle of incidence during the winter time, when we don't get a whole lot of sun. Okay, if you got a relatively flat roof, when we get most of our sun, it's directly overhead, so you're going to benefit from that. But again, it's one of the things that works against us. You can install a tracking system that will, you can put in the data and it will track where the sun's at and all that, but those are extremely expensive and not practical for rooftop or private ownership applications. Okay, another is our pervasive cloud cover. I got this information from NOAA, and they say their data shows that for 7 months we live under skies that have 80% cloud cover. Okay, so that is another thing that we have working against us.
So back to your question, Commissioner Hunt, so if you take the 693 kilowatts, so one of the things that we talk about in this industry is we talk about capacity, and then we talk about energy. So you would take that 693 and you would multiply it times 24 hours in a day, and then times 365 days in a year. And that would give you the potential kilowatt hours that would be available for sale. But when you get to, and you start to look at cloud cover and other things, then you start to, that number starts to dwindle, because in reality, it's not available, those number of hours. But that's the math you would do, and a typical Central Lincoln customer, so the average customer, uses just under 1,000 kilowatt hours per month. So that's how you could, you know, kind of, if you like to play with numbers, that's how you could translate those numbers.
Thank you.
Okay, and then also, this last bullet point here came from a study that the National Renewable Energy Laboratory did for the state of Hawaii. Hawaii was looking at some large-scale solar for their energy needs, because their primary source of energy, unlike us, is diesel fuel. So diesel fuel power generators. So this was an interesting bit of information that to show the impact of cloud cover on a solar panel, one single cumulus cloud passing over a panel can reduce that panel's output by 80%. So you can see what our cloud cover actually does to a system. Okay. And then also, photovoltaic generation is great for the customer, but it does pose some impacts to the utility, the serving utility. As solar systems are generating and dumping excess power onto the grid, our system has to be able to handle that. And so we're not to the point here in Newport or in Lincoln County where we're having a problem with so much solar that on a sunny summer day, it's putting excess power into our grid. And so our substations curtail what they're supplying to the system. And then a big cloud bank moves over, the generation cuts off, and then all of a sudden there's a big dip in power quality. It's not necessarily a problem for us now, but there are some cities in the United States that are experiencing severe power quality issues because of that, and it's causing large problems. Okay, so this map here gives you a really good visual representation of solar availability in the United States. You can see up there, we're in the top left corner right on the 45th parallel, and we live in practically almost the worst spot in the nation for solar accessibility. It makes sense the closer we get to the equator, the warmer it gets, the more sun they have. Of course, you get better, but it just gives you a really good idea of what we're up against here as far as the ability. So even if you have a nice system and we have a good year, you're still not going to get as much as, say, those same panels would get down in Medford. Okay. Here's another a nice representation. This information came off of the website for the Central or the Coast Community College. They put up years ago. They put up initially a 6 kilowatt system, so that's 6,000 watts of capacity, and they've since added on to that. But you can see here, this was it's kind of hard to see in the picture there, but it was taken in on the 25th of October. It was a nice sunny day, and their 6,000 watt system was producing 4,700 watts peak during the highest portion of the day. But you can kind of see it was up there for most of the day. It was doing a really good job. Just a few days later, on a cloudy day, you can see that the peak it hit was 1.3, and that was only for a very short period of time. Okay, so another thing that we hear a lot is the carbon-free, we want to be clean energy users, we want to lower our carbon footprint. And for customers of Central Lincoln PUD, we purchase all of our power from Bonneville Power. And this is their 2015 reported power mix percentages. And you can see down at the bottom there that there is no coal in our power mix that we're purchasing. There's very little biomass and waste. Natural gas is just 0.1, and that's the natural gas is mostly for spot. So in the event that there's a large spike in demand, the dams cannot ramp up and ramp down fast enough, so they will use spot generation from natural gas power generators to meet that demand. The non-specific market purchases there is their third largest portion. That's mostly hydro purchases from non-federally owned dams in the Washington, Canada region.
Okay.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Each of those different types of power have a cost. And some of it's very expensive. Can you explain to me a little bit about what some of the cost ranges might be in those power supplies? Because if you increase some of those more expensive ones, it's going to make a big difference in your rate that you're paying.
So, So, for instance, this fuel mix, which is the Bonneville fuel mix, we buy power under a 20-year contract with Bonneville called a preferred PF power. So that is that we have a preferred lien as a public utility on the output of the Federal Columbia River Power System, the FCRPS is what it's called. And we pay right now about $35 a megawatt hour for the power that we buy from Bonneville, which includes this mix. So solar, on the other hand, I think you have a slide later that actually gets at some of the cost of that. But I think we could say that, well, here's a number. I think it was when we were, when we have been looking at offshore wind. So the offshore wind projects that, that we have looked at in this region, the cost for that can be up to 10 times what we're paying for hydropower under the Federal Columbia River Power System. So that's, that is an extreme, and that's partly because the cost of maintaining, because you're so far out to sea, there is no cost. You can't roll a truck up and take care of it. So you're dealing with a really cost-effective or really ineffective maintenance cost versus even the construction or initial cost. And I would say that solar right now is probably running 100?
Yeah.
In the $100 range. And coming down. I mean, again, Wade is absolutely correct. It is coming down on a, in a consistent way because of the cost of the solar panels themselves are dropping fairly dramatically. And wind is probably in the 60.
Yeah, I'd probably say closer to 70.
Yeah, 67. So that's, and wind has come way down. I mean, I've been in this industry for 20 years, and when I started working here, wind was $130, and that was 20 years ago. So in today's, you know, that was, so it's...
Right. And natural gas is dirt cheap.
Dirt
right
cheap.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the issue.
Thank you.
And the other issue
exactly
is...
Exactly what I wanted to know.
Yeah, right. The other issue is, and Wade alluded to this, but when we talk about power quality, customers want high-quality power. And generally what that means is they want reliable all the time, no sags, you know, flat, always their power at the same level, so their electronics and other devices operate without issue. And so the reason natural gas, quite frankly, is popular today is because natural gas is an easy on, easy off power source. So natural gas is generally, I think you go into this a little more, natural gas backs renewables. That is the primary resource that's used to back renewables. And so the struggle is that as we bring on more renewables without cost-effective battery storage, which again, we've talked about this, it's right on the horizon. You know, Commissioner, we talked about this. That will be a game changer. But until that is available, we're backing renewables with natural gas, and we are, in essence, putting carbon into our environment through natural gas plants in order to backstop those renewables in a way that allows them to come on and off based on the go back to the slide Wade showed on the cloudy day at the community college, they can back in those instances.
Thank you. So I'm going to ask for clarification on some of that information. I guess I was surprised to learn that solar is more expensive than wind. Again, my impression being sun shines everywhere. The wind doesn't blow everywhere, but I guess maybe on the Oklahoma plains. If that
recognize that wind is expensive, less expensive because wind is not a good. I'm not talking about distributed wind. So I'm talking about utility scale wind where you have wind farms, which any resource that's built at a utility scale level is going to be more cost effective just to maintain than when you do distributed generation where it's at the customer home.
Okay, I guess I'm still confused. So the wind farms are cheaper than solar farms, or are there not solar farms?
No, utility-scale solar would be more cost-effective. I don't know, to be honest with you. I can't tell you the difference between utility scale solar and utility scale wind. I'm talking about distributed generation or rooftop solar versus utility scale wind. So the cost
Does
that make sense?
Yeah. There's a little bit of apples and oranges.
Yeah.
One of the reasons for the data is that there's not very many utility scale solar operations, as opposed to wind farms have been around for decades, and now, you know, over the last 20 years they've really started to populate. But large scale utility sized solar is still relatively in its infancy.
Although they're starting. I mean, and mm-hmm. certainly like in Hawaii and the islands where, you know, again, where you have a constant source of sun and the alternative was diesel, Kauai as an island, I think, is moving to almost entirely solar and with great success.
Right. Right. It's in some places it makes total sense compared to what that situation has. And that's kind of what the gist of all this is what is solar, you know, rooftop solar versus what is works well and we already have just here.
This is one of the few times I've seen where global warming may be a benefit, Dory.
Okay. So now let's talk a little bit about solar panels in the event of an earthquake or tsunami or whatever we may have here. One of the biggest things that we're hearing now is I'm hearing, yeah, you know, when the big one hits, I want to be able to generate my own power and I don't have to worry about how long it takes you guys to get out and put up wires. Okay. Without battery backup systems, most of these systems will not be able to provide power. And that's just the cold, hard truth. The inverters that these systems are connected to, and the inverter changes the voltage from a DC to an AC, from direct current to alternating current, okay? The inverters have technology in them, and it's a safety feature so that if the inverter senses that there's no power on the grid side, it shuts off power flow, okay? So that's in the event that there's a power outage, we have line crews out working, and this is a national standard, that there's line crews out working on the lines, and all of a sudden the sun comes up in the morning and hits these panels, and we don't start backfeeding electricity out into what our alignment think are deadlines. Okay? So, that's an electrical code, it's a safety requirement that these inverters have. Some of the new ones on the market, and this is how it's being sold as a, you know, source of generation in the case of a disaster, is some of the newer inverters have the ability to provide power to one designated 110 outlet, and it's almost always located right there at the inverter. So that would give somebody the ability to operate a radio, maybe operate their refrigerator on a spot basis, depending on, you know, if there's actually sun. So the ability to use this as a generation source in the event of a disaster is very skeptical at best. Without battery backup. If you have battery backup, then you can go out, throw a manual disconnect, and feed it that way and get fed off of the batteries, not directly from the inverter. Because the batteries will allow the inverter to see voltage on the other side. Okay.
I was having an interesting conversation with somebody last week. I can't remember who it was in the industry, but the notion was, and maybe this is already the case and you know, but so the newer systems have different inverters. Is there a way to require solar companies who are doing business like in your area or in our state to only install those newer inverters? Do you get where I'm going with that? Because someone said, you know, that might be a solution if there was a way to require that systems that go in post whatever date have that capability.
I don't know that there's anything stopping us from requiring that, but I would have to check the state statutes because the state requires us to offer net metering.
Right.
And it would all be dependent on what their rules would allow us to exclude.
It's an interesting thing.
It is. And I think as time goes on, especially with the cost of storage coming down, you know, storage now is the new solar panels 20 years ago. So in 20 years from now, solar panels will be really, really cheap. and batteries will be right where we're at with solar prices. So that's the thinking. So in the event of a full Cascadia subduction zone, these rooftop solar systems, not only will the inverters not allow them to feed, but you're probably looking at solar panels that need, in systems that need repair. If we start to get homes shaking and foundations buckling, that rooftop's going to buckle, frames are going to get bent, connections are going to get lost, and there you go. Okay, so now let's move into the economics of solar. So, like I mentioned earlier, the costs have decreased significantly. 2007, they were about $9.50 per watt. Now that's down to less than half, $4 a watt. Okay. One of the things that makes it cost available for people to put in is the heavy subsidies of the state and federal tax credit levels. Right now, the state is offering $1.70 a watt up to $6,000 for a system. And you do have to take that over a few years. And the federal tax credit is 30% of the system cost. The feds don't matter. They don't care how big it is, how much you're paying per watt. They just give you flat 30% of the system cost. We have our incentives at Central Lincoln. We give up to $2,000 for residential solar and up to $5,000 for solar on businesses. But our incentives are not unlimited. Our budget every year is getting, we're getting closer and closer to that number that we set aside and exceeding that. We've not yet had to tell somebody no on an incentive because we're out of funds. But if that trajectory keeps continuing, we're either forced with starting to turn customers away or increase our budget. Of course, every time we increase our budget, then that's costs that have to be spread out amongst all of our customers.
So this fund from the state is budget, used to state budget. If you multiply it out by a number of people and they get close to the $6,000, that's a lot of money, plus your administration cost that's coming out of the general fund that goes to education and all the other projects. So this is not free money. It's just...
You're right.
We're just taking money from one place and giving to the people that want to build solar power.
Right. And we've now started to see states are, in fact, starting to pool some. I know Nevada, PUC, is just announced that they're pooling subsidies for solar. And so you're going to start to see, as prices have come down, you're going to start to see these state and federal subsidies start to decrease. Because it is, as the popularity grows, you know, if the state of Oregon did 200 solar systems this year at up to $6,000, well, what happens if that becomes $2,000? What if, or 2,000 customers? What happens if it becomes 20,000 customers? All of a sudden, you start to see large chunks of state cash go out the door for this when we could be using it somewhere else.
And even in this state, they're not. We're not. We don't have that. But just in the last week, there's been some stuff I've read. So there was a movement to start to tighten things down. I think the folks have chosen to back off. And this is at the PUC level, so this would not affect Central Lincoln, but it would be with how the PUC is regulating the investor-owned utilities. I think they've agreed to step back and take a little more time to study it, but clearly it's already something that folks are starting to look at for PacifiCorp and PGE. And I think, you know, I think the where you were going, Commissioner Thompson, gets at the nub, and I think, what's your next slide? I think one of our concerns is that, yeah, where you look here, is that... it winds up even that, you know, you're talking about the macro level at a state level, but even at the micro level, you know, we have a revenue requirement to recover our costs. And most of those costs, other than power costs, which is about half of our budget, most of the rest of those costs are not necessarily driven by the number of units or kilowatt hours that our customers buy. They're driven by the need to have infrastructure in the air and poles and wires and people that can go out and repair those when needed. And so the struggle that, or the thing that we worry, I wouldn't say it's a struggle, but we worry and watch, is that what tends to happen is customers who can afford to make an investment. Go to that next slide, maybe.
Okay, well, and also just to touch on that, our rates here are really low.
They are really low. But customers that can bear an 8.5-year simple payback on a rooftop solar system, that's great. They're obviously customers who financially have the means to do so. And then what happens is as consumption goes down over time, customers who cannot afford to make that kind of investment, they're seeing rates go up. They're bearing a larger percentage of the fixed costs of the utility. I'm not suggesting that that's what that's what's happening here. As we said, 55 customers or so, it's not a big deal. But we know that that social issue is one that's playing out all across the United States. And PUCs and other regulatory bodies are having to think about how to price products in ways that don't unfairly disadvantage customers who can't afford to play in the solar market.
So this is a slide just covers the simple cost breakdown of a sample 3300 watt system that one of our customers installed. The cost is there, all of the different tax credits and incentives. And to a customer, they see that bottom line of, wow, I get all this and it's only $2,200. Great. But as you can see, they're only saving $263 with our rates today. And so you're looking at a pretty long payback. These systems, the panels have about a 20-year lifespan. That's how long that they're rated to actually produce a certain percentage of their overall capacity, because as the panels age, their capacity will lower. And then anything that we stick outside here on the Oregon coast almost inevitably never makes it to its initial lifespan.
That's what it's the other question. If you estimated the distance, if you're right next to the ocean, of course you're a lot more corrosion than if you're a mile back.
Correct. Yeah,
I mean, seeing in that range, if you're right up next to the ocean.
Correct, Commissioner. We see that a lot. If we put up street lights in Nye Beach, they have about a third of the lifespan of the same street light in Toledo.
Oh, yeah.
So it really does matter. Unfortunately for us, we don't go very far in. You know, we do serve Siletz and Toledo and Mapleton and Swiss Home, but for the most part, we are strictly a Highway 101 utility.
But that very issue is the one, when Wade gets to it, that makes community solar potentially a more attractive option for us, because we can site it in Toledo or Mapleton or an area where there's considerably less cloud cover and therefore much better economics.
Right. Okay. And so, you know, when I talk to folks, when they call, the first thing I ask them is, what is your goal? Why are you wanting to do solar? And I usually get that laundry list that I showed early. Almost always, everybody says, I want to save money. I want to save money on my bill. And Central Lincoln is 100% in favor of customers saving money on their bill. We've been doing stuff for a long time to help customers save money. You know, when I give the facts about solar in our service territory, I do have some people say, well, you don't want me to stop buying power from you. You just don't want to stop making money. Well, Central Lincoln's not about making money. It's about serving reliable power at a low cost to our customers. That's what a public utility or a people's utility district does. So we've had a big list of other options customers can pursue to save money on their bill. We offer incentives for high-efficiency heating and cooling systems. We've been doing weatherization in our service district for 20 years, replacing, windows, adding insulation to homes. These are all, we have financial incentives to do this. We give incentives for energy-efficiency energy-efficient appliances, lighting upgrades to help businesses and industrial settings increase the efficiency and quality of their lighting in their spaces. And then we even do full-scale, in-depth custom projects through Bonneville's engineering department for commercial and industrial projects. So this next slide. And most of these options have a much better financial payback than renewable energy does, whether it be solar or wind or even microhydro. We do offer an incentive. If somebody had a small creek, we could do microhydro. We don't have any yet, but we could. This graph here shows how many kilowatt hours we've saved all the way back to 1982. You can see it. That's, and those are in thousands. So the peak there was back in 94. We saved 10 million kilowatt hours. Okay, that's, I mean, this is, we're talking a lot of power. The average home only uses about 11,000 to 12,000 kilowatt hours a year. So you can see that we have a long history of saving, helping our customers save money on their bills.
And those numbers, by the way, are those numbers that you see in front of you are the amount of savings we acquired in the given year. But when we think of those savings, we actually think of them as cumulative, because they are, once a measure has been implemented in a household, the savings continue indefinitely.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, these are savings here are all reported to Bonneville first-year savings. So that $10 million we saved in 1994, we're still saving those 10 million kilowatt hours today, or at least a good portion of them, depending on what the measure life was for what we did.
What happened in 94 to cause that?
You know, I'd have to go back and look at the records. It predates me here, but it could have been a very large industrial project. Whenever we see large spikes like that, it's usually a big industrial project. Like for our residential and stuff like that, we probably average about $5 million a year. If we get a large industrial, it'll bump it up. So, and a lot of this, you know, you can see down in 96 and 97 and 99 and 2000, there's almost no savings. That usually goes with Bonneville funding mechanisms.
Right.
Okay, so Bonneville funds these dollars back to us for these programs, but they collect it in the rates anyways. So our customers are paying for it in their rates. Comes through us and our bill, Bonneville then returns it back to us to do these kind of projects.
I mentioned or said that the cost of power that we buy from Bonneville is about $35 per megawatt hour, and about $2.30 of that is specifically for energy efficiency. So that's the percentage of what we spend to Bonneville, and it's interesting. We've actually just done some math. In this state, the investor-owned utilities are required to pay 3% that goes into the Energy Trust of Oregon, and those are public purpose funds. And so that was part of the RPS standard and legislation that happened over a period of time back in the 90s. And we recently went through and did the math for us, and based on the amount of money that we're paying to Bonneville through our rates, we're actually paying 3.6% of our revenue is also going to energy efficiency for our customers. So we feel pretty good about that.
We do. So as Deborah mentioned earlier, one of the new things that we're looking for is, because we know that, you know, all of this stuff that we've talked about here still doesn't get to the fact that the one bullet point that people said early on, when I mentioned early on, was that the technology is cool. People want to partake in this technology. It may not make sense on a financial basis for the average person. The generation is less than average for our nation. But people still want to partake in it. They believe in it. They want to help further it, because the more people do it, the lower the prices come and all those things. So the idea of community solar is something that we're actually, you know, really starting to look at, and that would involve Central Lincoln purchasing and maintaining a large photovoltaic system, and we can site it in a place, you know, for that customer who lives right down here in Nye Beach, say, who gets almost, you know, no sun. Maybe we find a spot out in Siletz or out in Toledo where we get much more sun. We all know that 8 miles makes a world of difference. And then we allow people to buy into that. They can maybe buy a portion of the panels or buy a portion of the output, and then they're investing in solar without actually having to purchase it and put it in a location that is maybe not best suited. Even somebody in Toledo may have great sunny days, but the orientation of their house may be really bad. If you don't have a south-facing roof, you know, if you've got an A-frame house and it faces east and west, you don't have a good place to put it. This allows those customers. It also allows people who rent. A lot of people don't own homes, who want to participate in solar. It allows them to buy in and receive the benefits that way. So, you know, Central Lincoln is going to continue offering our incentives, and our customers want those incentives, and but we also want to offer an alternative to private ownership of solar panels for those customers who want to partake or and purchase, but don't have the best situation for it.
Okay, Commissioner Thompson.
Well, it's been very interesting because it's one of the world's biggest problems is, of course, energy production. But so if you're paying 3.5 cents from Bonneville and you're about a 50% cost in just lines and stuff, so it's about 7 cents to 7.5 cents is your cost, am I correct? And then solar power comes in at today's cost at about what cents per kilowatt hour?
Yeah, it's. I'd have to go back and look at some of the data on the utility scale side. I don't want to give you a number that
I actually
don't.
Took a note here. I'll send you a resource stack. I'll send you some information as a follow up that shows
because
what
this is kind of critical if you're talking about community power, mm-hmm. because that's what we're talking about. It's a bunch of people saying this is a good thing, mm-hmm. and the first thing you're going to say, okay, what's it going to cost me, and you know, it's got to be somewhat competitive so that the person, the individual, is willing to buy into this. And that's why I think that's
what... And that's what community solar does, is it allows people to buy in. The challenge is that because of net metering and because of the way states have set up... And again, it's so hard not to wind up sounding like we are in it. And we are not... negative on solar. We believe that solar will be a part of our resource mix going forward, and we sit around at the utility and we talk about how can we participate in this in a way that benefits customers, meets their needs, and doesn't hurt financially other customers. That's the challenge, and we will figure that out. But it is really tough because you can't charge solar customers differently than you charge your other customers. Under the current state laws and net metering laws, I can't charge in some states, they're starting to look at this, I think Nevada's one, where the PUC will allow a higher monthly fixed charge for customers who have rooftop solar installed because they're not collecting their costs through the unit charge. So it seems appropriate to charge them a higher fixed charge so that they're contributing again to the cost of the wires and the poles that are the backup system. Well, state law doesn't allow us to do that. So we must hold those customers currently. They must pay the same rate. And the other piece that happens, and this is interesting. So if you have a system, and this doesn't happen often for us, but this is more of a societal problem. If you have a system, and the way net metering works is it says customers get a credit based on the revenue. So, and at Central Lincoln, if you install a system, and we have a super, super sunny summer, and you are generating more power than you use in June, and in July and in August, what anything that you didn't use to offset that current month, anything you generated in excess, moves forward month by month. Once a year, we're required to true it up. And when we true it up, you get, from month to month, you are getting credit at the retail rate. So you're offsetting the full amount of revenue. You're not offsetting my power cost. You're offsetting the full amount of revenue that you would have otherwise used. It's only that once a year when you true up that I can actually offset it at my avoided cost of power. That's what creates the economical issues. Does that make sense to you, what I'm saying?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I want to just make one final comment. The community solar seems to make sense to me, mm-hmm. if, you know, you've got to convince people what it is, because mm-hmm. to do it, then all of a sudden, you take all these customers that are willing to buy into it. Yes, it will be a little more expensive, but it'll come down over time. That's right. One of the things that shows if you invest early, it'll come down
yes.
over time. And it looks like to me it costs a lot to put in individual units. You can optimize it.
Yes.
I mean, there's better places to be. It looks like it would be a good investment, because one of the things I hear most commonly in this community is they want a power supply besides hydropower that they can withstand it. You can build a community
solar system, so it will withstand shaking and probably survive for a community.
And you can cite it directionally and locationally, because again, when we sit here and we talk about, well, what's the cost of communities of any solar resource, it's all dependent on what your cloud cover is. So that's why it's hard to get at the cost per unit of solar here versus in Florida, completely different. So because you've got that named capacity, but what really impacts your cost other than the actual install cost is what you're generating. So yes, I think community solar could make a lot of sense for us. The other thing is that as we're looking at building, well, we're building our new facility in Newport, and we have a 1.5% solar investment requirement for the public utility as a public building, and so we will also have an opportunity to get our hands wet, if you will. We'll be siting solar panels on our facility. We'll be getting an opportunity to understand how that works for us, and that'll be I think we all view that as actually a very cool opportunity, and that's going to be a reasonably sized investment, because I don't know, Gail, what is it, $200,000 probably for solar panels that we'll be putting.
Well, the other thing I like is you got people that are in the power business doing the maintenance. I don't want the maintenance problems.
Myself, as an individual homeowner. You know what this reminds me of a lot? And tell me if you think that, like, what we've done with trying to manage passenger vehicles, commercial vehicles, you know, we've mandated and incentivized higher mileage, hybrids, all of that, which has produced a lot of great environmental benefits, and yet one of the main consequences, we've seen gas tax revenues go down, and we don't have the resource there to maintain the road system that we once had. So it's a balancing, like in so many things, of costs and benefits, and if necessary, finding new ways to pay for things.
I hadn't thought about that. It's a great analogy.
Yeah.
And I will also say that, you know, just talk to your friends, talk to your neighbors. I mean, partly on the energy efficiency side, as we have incorporated new standards and, you know, all appliances, for instance, now are produced at a more efficient level. So what happens is Bonneville adjusts over time the incentives that they provide for things, because to the extent something is the standard, it's socialized across all items, there's no longer a reason to incent it, just like automobiles and fuel efficiency. So, you know, today, right now, it is harder for us. Bonneville just changed their numbers last October, and it is harder for us right now to move those energy efficiency dollars. So we have money. If you know of people, or if you are, you know, talk to constituents who are struggling in any way, this is a great time to look and talk to the PUD about opportunities to install energy efficiency incentives.
Yeah. Great presentation, very educational. Anything from you, Commissioner Hunt?
I think as an economist, you've provided a lot of information to answer some of my questions. You look at, when I toured Germany recently, everywhere you drove, there were solar rooftop panels. So you go, okay, why don't we do it here? Well, you've provided a lot of information. Who knows, there may be different incentives and all kinds of reasons that, and it's not throughout Europe. Again,
right.
I was in different countries. But
well, you know, it's funny because I get the Germany phone call.
Mm-hmm. I do.
You know, I've lived in Germany, and Germany looks a lot like Western Oregon. It's just damp, cloudy. But they're paying about 35 cents a kilowatt hour for power.
And that was the next point I've got on my notes here. The cost of power is incredibly, I guess, varied throughout the world.
Right.
And even if you look at East Coast, which is pretty much fossil fuel-generated power, much more expensive than hydroelectric. And again, if you're trying to avoid fossil fuel energy, hydroelectric is pretty fossil fuel-free.
Right.
Fossil
fuel-free
energy. So, and then Commissioner Thompson already covered my comments about similarities to the challenges in the transportation systems.
And Commissioner Thompson had another point.
The one thing we haven't talked about is the power grid itself. If we were to go to this, one thing that's hard about solar power is it's such a peak
situation. So you have to have a power grid that's much more robust than you do if one that comes from hydropower where it's consistent. Do we have a power grid that can handle a large amount of solar?
I think that that's a really good question, and actually Bruce Loveland, who's our chief engineer, after we had spoken before, he did some work, and he's going to be summarizing that, and then we'll get it out to you as well, just a sense, at least from one electrical engineer, what the sense of grid issues looking at Germany versus the United States. But I think that I don't know whether our grid is sufficient, but I do know that grid instability, and Wade touched on it early on, is a huge issue with respect to intermittent resources of any type, and solar, because it is the current growth opportunity, has really been spurring that on, and a lot of work is being done. And again, it becomes a cost sharing mechanism even as you look at hardening the grid and making investments in that, that Bonneville and PacifiCorp and other folks who own the transportation system are working on. Who pays for those costs? And that is a societal issue that we haven't resolved.
So let me, because we mentioned Germany quite a bit, and I don't think maybe we mentioned what the problem was. And they went to a lot of solar power and offshore wind, and they reached a maximum where their grid wouldn't take it. And so that literally they have to shut down some of their upcoming projects because
right.
the grid wasn't right. So well, just, I wanted to explain what was going on.
The real problem with that is, so far, our two biggest forms of renewable energy are wind and solar, and neither one of them produces well when the power is needed most.
Right.
Okay, wind is blowing in mostly at the dead of night, and solar is doing its best work during the middle of the day. Both of those are non-peak times. So now the biggest question and the biggest push right now is utility-sized storage. So as these renewable energy sources are putting power out onto the grid, there's a place for it to go. So it's not being used in homes and businesses, but now we can store it up in batteries so that when the peaks hit and the solar's gone and the wind's gone, we can draw out of those batteries. So that's the next iteration of utility change.
And the issue that we have had, the issue that's very close to what you're mentioning here in the Northwest, has had to do with wind and a runoff, the hydro system. So as those two systems have attempted, or we have operated the grid with both those systems going, there have been times where the wind is blowing and you had a lot of merchant plants, folks who put up wind plants based on production tax credit and economics that required them to generate at a certain level. And so in the spring, their systems are putting out a ton of wind. Now you have a ton of, you have a particularly wet winter with a lot of runoff, and you have a lot of water, and you can't spill the water because you'll hurt the fish. So the only option is to run the water, curtail the wind generators, and then what Bonneville and others have had to do is then pay these folks to not generate wind. So that reminds you of a lot of other, you know, ag and other things in our history where you are essentially paying someone not to do something because they made a decision in good, you know, they made a decision, an economic decision, and invested in something and thought it made sense, and now you're telling them they can't operate. But the grid can't take more than it, you can't put more in without storage, you can't put more in than you can take out.
So, and we got to go on with this
presentation.
One last comment. When you decide you really got a program for community wind, I hope you'll come back to the county, because we are community solar.
We will.
Because we are a big power purchaser.
Mm-hmm.
And we hear all the time, I think all of us hear mm-hmm. all the time, they want us to get more involved with renewable energy. And this is, I think, makes a sensible way to do it. But
yep.
you'll
yep.
have to get farther along on the project.
Well, we'll work with Mark. We'll continue to work with Mark on that. And we're, you know, we have a commitment, a shared commitment between the county and Central Lincoln to work in general on ways that we can talk about cost savings for customers through distributed generation as well as energy efficiency. So appreciate the opportunity very much to come and talk with you. And I will follow up with you on the two items that we discussed.
Thanks for coming. Great
Thank
presentation.
You. Thank you.
All right, next up, we've got an update on
public health accreditation. So when our presenters come forward, and we'll look forward to learning more about this.
Good morning, Commissioners. I'm Rebecca Austin, and I'm the Public Health Division Director, and I want to introduce you to Nicole Fields, who is our new Health Promotion Manager, and she's also our Accreditation Coordinator. So we're here today to sort of update you on public health accreditation. We are, this month, we're going to officially apply to begin that process. We've been working about 2 years to get some basic documentation in order, and now we're ready to push the button, which gives us a year to get all the documentation in before the site visit, and they come and actually hopefully accredit us. But we thought it would be important to come and tell you a little bit about accreditation and how it may affect you and the county. So I'm going to let Nicole take it from here.
Good morning. Thanks for having us. So as Rebecca mentioned, this is a really exciting month for us. We will be submitting our application to the Public Health Accreditation Board, or FAB, for public health accreditation. Just a little refresher on what public health accreditation is for our department. It's going to be the measurement of the health department performance against a set of nationally recognized practice-focused and evidence-based standards. It is a national program, and at this point, about 50% of the population of the United States is served by an accredited health department, so it's becoming very important for us. National Public Health Department accreditation has been developed because of a desire to improve service, value, and accountability to community partners. So while it is internal for us at the Public Health Department, it's also really important for how we serve the community and holding ourselves to a set standard to make sure that we're giving the best service to the community that we possibly can. So some themes of accreditation, quality improvement, planning, partnership, community engagement, leadership and governance, and customer and community focus. We also put the 10 essential services of public health up there in the wheel on the right-hand side, just as kind of a reminder that those things are always going to be kind of themes that we strive for in our public health practice, and they're also going to be important for accreditation. So why are we seeking accreditation? Besides what I mentioned before, it's that QI focus, that we're continually focusing on improving the health department and making those changes to hold ourselves to that really high set standard. We're increasing our credibility and accountability to the community. So by being accredited, we're showing that we're credible to the community and holding ourselves to that accreditation standard, so that we're holding ourselves accountable. It's a national recognition for excellence in public health practice. It will increase our opportunity to recruit and retain top-notch public health professionals. With the amount of accredited health departments that are now available for people to work for, it really is becoming that kind of extra little carrot for employees that are seeking to work for a nationally accredited health department. We can access a network of public health experts. There are a lot of resources that are available to accredited health departments and potential funding advantages. It'll make us more competitive for national grants, and some state grants in the future could possibly require accreditation. That's not something that's come down the pike in Oregon yet, but some other states have started to make that move. So here's our timeline to give you an idea of what we'll be working on. September 2016, we'll be submitting our application. In November, Rebecca and I will be attending the in-person training. It's right around the election day, so easy to remember. Through September 2017, we'll be working real hard to submit and compile all of our documents. Hundreds of documents will be going into the system. We'll be writing some new policies as well as updating some that we have. Some of our major plans like workforce development and our strategic plan are very important to this, and we'll be making sure that they're up to the accreditation standards. So that's basically a year-long process. We'll have submitted all of our documents by September 2017, and hopefully by the end of 2017 we'll have our site visit. And then around the end of 2017/beginning of 2018, we will hopefully be celebrating our public health accreditation. So we wanted to bring to you some key domains that we'll be relying on you and working with you with to achieve our accreditation. So you can see which domains they are, and we'll go into a little bit of a further detail on all of those for you. So policies and plans is going to be the first one. We want to make sure that we're staying informed of public health issues that you all are discussing. So by attending meetings, by giving you updates on what we're working on, and contributing to any of your deliberations concerning public policy and practice. And then also informing you if there's any public health impacts of policies that you're considering already, or policies that are proposed on a statewide level. If we have some public health knowledge that might help you make decisions on those, we hope to contribute those as well. Public health laws. So for accreditation, we're required to submit at least 2 written reviews of current or proposed laws to you within the past 5 years. So I think that that would concern a lot of the tobacco work, some of our immunization work possibly, but just really keeping that relationship open on when laws are coming up, that if they have a public health impact, we're hoping to be involved with them. Workforce. So accreditation and workforce development really, really go hand in hand. And like I mentioned, it really can help us recruit those new people, but also increase our staff satisfaction and make sure that we have, you know, a competent but also a satisfied workforce. So you can help us by supporting our recruitment and retention activities, supporting training budgets and requests for professional development, and supporting policies that provide a supportive work environment for our staff. So administration and management would be the next domain. And this is just, we need participation. We need you to support our having participation from IT, legal, and personnel. This is a lot of our real basic documentation that we need to get submitted, but we will need help from outside sources. So, for example, legal is on here because we need to document that we have access to legal counsel for public health if needed.
Go on the record, you got access.
There we go. And then 12 is a whole domain on governance, so obviously y'all are very important for that. We need to provide written record of your structure, composition, and authority over the public health department. Make sure that we have communication with you regarding our responsibility to you and our responsibility to the community. We need to communicate with you, as I mentioned, about important public health issues, review those issues, discuss if there were actions taken or policies adopted or recommendations made. And then also for our structure internally, that we would need to talk to you about our plans and process for improving our health department performance, and then the steps that we're taking towards action for those recommendations. And this is just something I found interesting, that they did a national survey through the CDC that studied health departments that have already achieved accreditation and asked how they felt it helped their performance as a health department. And 90% of the departments that were studied reported that improved their quality improvement within the health department, and improve their performance improvement opportunities, and increased accountability and transparency both within their health department and throughout the community, and improve their management processes as well. So I know I kind of flew through that, but if you have questions for us, I'm happy to answer.
I do have a couple, and thank you for the presentation, and certainly we want to make sure at our level we do everything we can to support this important effort and make it a reality. I want to ask how this ties in, if at all, you know, in some of the previous presentations we've had related to public health, how the role nationally of public health seems to be evolving. Not that you're not going to continue to do all the important things you do, like managing disease outbreaks, immunizations, pool and restaurant inspections, among many others, but that how it seems like there's really an evolving role where public health is taking maybe a more significant role in community education and outreach and prevention and doing things that people might not have associated with public health efforts to really create healthier communities in all aspects. And do the two of these tie together in any way?
They really do go hand in hand. The majority of the documents that we submit for accreditation, for some of the domains like education and access to healthcare and outreach, those are all going to be population-based documents. Mm-hmm. So they're not really interested. Well, I don't want to say interested. They're interested, but they don't look so much for our accounting for our direct service portion of public health. They're more interested in the population-based services.
You might want to talk a little bit about modernization as well.
So just to add to that, so when I came on three years ago, there was no health promotion program in our public health division. And so we quickly recognized that we couldn't be accredited without that piece, because that's where all of our policy and our health education for the population goes. So we had to create that that department, that program, in order to move forward with accreditation. So that's the first thing we did. Right.
Now then, at the state policy level and the legislature, you know, not too long ago, the legislature was looking at the effectiveness of public health, and it seemed like there was going to be maybe even a movement perhaps to force regionalization, take it away from the county level, and regionalize it, and I think there was some significant pushback to that, and now the state's stepped back, and one of the things they have acknowledged, I'm pleased that it's at least it's been acknowledged, is that it ranks near the bottom of all the 50 states in funding of public health, but is there any kind of interplay directly or indirectly between the state, kind of the state's lens looking at public health, and the effort of public health departments to secure accreditation?
Yeah, I do think they're, fortunately, they are blending. I really think that what we're calling in Oregon the public health modernization movement is really more geared toward the population focus, which is also what accreditation is doing. So, and you know, we're going to be talking more about that. We are going to the legislature this year, this new session, and asking for more money to support our communicable disease, our environmental health, and our emergency preparedness work, because it's woefully underfunded. And the work that we're really expected to do now with more and more disease, you saw I brought that to you at the Walport meeting, where our diseases are just out of control. And we still get, you know, $50,000 a year to work that program. So that's not going to work anymore. And I think the state is really understanding that. Now, where they're going to come up with the money, let's hope that marijuana tax just keep rolling in. I don't know where else they're going to get it, but yeah, I do. I'm really happy that those two things are being knitted together. They're not two disparate things that we have to kind of keep juggling. We're all moving in the same direction.
Very good. Any comments or questions from my colleagues?
Well, I just think it's nice to see this process continuing. I believe Director Connell was in front of us maybe a year ago and spoke about the process, and it's nice to see it's reaching fruition. As you look at the process, you talked about some of the initial challenges. Are there still challenges now? I mean, areas that require more attention, areas that keep you awake at night, or at least partially awake?
I'll tell you about my area that keeps me awake and give a little plug for an event that we have coming up. And mine is the CHIP, Community Health Improvement Plan, and making sure that we're documenting our progress in that and that we have active community participation. And we're actually on September 29th from 3 to 5 over at the Center for Health Education having a Community Health Improvement Plan revival celebration to try and get some buy-in from community partners, some new people that haven't participated with us before, and just get people excited about it again and get those work groups, you know, coming together and forming and getting out of our silos and communicating again. And that's one area I think we really, really need to focus on for this, to make sure that we're having that community participation and community work towards the Community Health Improvement Plan.
Okay, I think I have that on my calendar.
Great.
Last it's time. On mine, too.
Perfect.
So I have something that keeps me up at night.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Don't forget me. No, I think Domain 11 is probably the one that keeps me up at night, and that's because we really need to work with other departments in the county, and I'm not real facile at that yet. So I think that that'll take a little bit of work and maybe some help from you all to figure out how we're going to do that.
Certainly would support that.
You bet.
My last comment would be, I think anytime an organization or an entity gets accredited, it speaks well of the leadership and the individuals and the employees within those departments. So good work, and look forward to success.
Thank you.
All right.
Thanks.
We move on to commissioners' reports. And I have been asked by the president of FOCUS, Friends of Lincoln County Animals, to share an announcement with the board. I think people in the community may already be aware that they've been negotiating for a while to purchase the current Seventh-day Adventist Church in Newport, which is a couple of blocks off of Olive Street, Highway 20. The purchase closed on September 1st, so this means now they've already started the process, but the thrift store operation will be consolidated at that site, so sometime in 2017 they'll be vacating their current space at the fairgrounds, but they haven't given us a firm date on that and said they'd give us notice there. Also, they wanted to publicly acknowledge that I guess only after they were somewhat into this process, they learned that the church was offering both shelter and food to several homeless people in the county, and they wanted us to know that they'll be working with the church, with the county, if we can be of support in any way, and the nonprofits, agencies to try and help mitigate the impact of that. Anything else from commissioners?
I have nothing to say.
Okay. Constituent input? Hearing none. Do we need an executive session, Mr. Belmont?
We do not.
Okay. We will see you 1 week from today, Wednesday, September 14th, right here. Until then, we're adjourned.